Okay, sorry about all the long introduction. This talk is going to be about the same subject you heard yesterday afternoon, and you might recognize some of the pictures already appearing yesterday. So there's going to be some overlap between my talk and Andrew Rutenberg's talk. So I'll try to minimize that, but I will nevertheless try to emphasize the parts of the experiments that I thought were important, first to draw the conclusions and then to compare to the available theories. I should say from the beginning that I'm not going to answer that question. We don't know exactly how the cell finds its center, at least not to the high accuracy that it does, and in fact we don't even know why it wants to find the center to that accuracy. The driving force behind that, behind this project is Ned Wingering from NEC, and it is being carried out together with Casey Wang from MIT. So the outline of the talk would be some introduction, and as I said, there are going to be some overlap, but I try to rush through that. Talk about cell division in E. coli, talk about the experiments and the existing theories, talk about our theory, which I will term as a minimal theory, and say why, equations, result, and then conclusions. So E. coli is a typical bacteria that divides, which means that it duplicates its DNA, and then it divides somewhere in the middle between the two DNA molecules. And it turns out that division is very accurate. It finds the center in very accurately. The first step in the division site selection is formation of FTSZ ring. FTSZ is a protein that attaches to the membrane and starts this septation process. And you can actually see where the FTSZ ring forms, and in fact, the formation of the FTSZ ring is in fact very accurate in the center. So the question is, how does the cell control the position of the FTSZ ring itself? It's just a name of a protein. I don't think it has a... I mean, I don't think the proteins have okay. So the first thing that you would think that the cell wants to do is not to divide where the DNA molecule, where the nucleoid is. So the FTSZ ring formation is inhibited by the nucleoid itself, by the chromosome. So when the chromosome separates, then the chromosome itself somehow inhibits division here. So by looking at it, you would really see that there are three areas where the cell can divide, in the center and at the poles. And how do you come to these conclusions? The way the biologists do this is by looking at mutants. And this particular mutant that you see here is a mutant where one of the proteins that is responsible for separating the two DNA molecules, the two chromosomes, is knocked off. So that the two DNA molecules are attached, they cannot separate. And if you look at the FTSZ ring in these molecules, in these cells, you can see that the FTSZ ring forms not in the center and not on the sides, but on the two sides of the DNA molecule. So the conclusion you can draw from this is that there are no a priori defined partition sites. Something that was believed in the biology community, that somehow the center has some kind of a signature where the FTSZ ring comes to it and attaches to it. Actually, this shows that it can attaches anywhere as long as the DNA is not there. And there are some exceptions. Sometimes it does cut the DNA in half. Now, what happens in such, if you look at such mutants, if you cut the, if the cell divides here, then of course this part of the cell has no DNA molecule. It's there's no nucleoid in. So if you look, for example, at a different mutant that has as a different different molecule, different protein knocked off, but basically leads to the same result. The DNA does not separate. You can see that if you look now at the cells, then there is one cell, for example, in this picture, where the DNA, which is dyed in red, the DNA does not appear at all. So this cell has no DNA, DNA at all. But if you look at the FTSZ ring, the FTSZ ring forms at the center. So there is something that directs the FTSZ to the center even without the nucleoid. And the culprit, as was already mentioned yesterday, is this bunch of proteins that is the mean operon, which includes three, at E. coli includes three proteins, mean C, D, and E, and people know, of course, exactly the genetic content of those proteins. So if you knock out this operon, if you don't, the cell does not have this mean C, D, and proteins, you can see that the FTSZ ring, which is the green here, actually forms not only in the center, but also forms at the poles. So FTSZ, the mean protein, mean operon, is responsible for eliminating the division sites at the pole, which I think you heard yesterday. Okay, so what are the observations concerning the mean proteins? There are three mean proteins. Mean C is the one that interacts directly with the FTSZ. That's clear from in vitro studies. If you knock out mean C, you get mini cells, which means that the cell also divides at the poles. So the mean C is the one that is responsible for inhibiting division. And overexpression of mean C leads to filaments, which means that if you have too much mean C, it actually inhibits division everywhere, and the cell just grows and grows and grows. I'll show you some pictures. The mean D protein is the one that actually recruits mean C to the membrane. Mean D is an ATPase, which means that it needs ATP to function, but once it gets ATP, it can attach to the membrane, and it is the one that can attach mean C with it to the membrane, and this complex is the one that prevents division. So if you don't have mean D, then the mean C, which is responsible for inhibition, cannot attach to the membrane, and there is no inhibition, which means that you get mini cells. You get division also at the site, at the poles. The numbers, as was mentioned yesterday, are about 1,000 per micron. If you knock out the mean E, you get filaments, which means that the mean D and C by themselves actually inhibit division everywhere. So if I just do say all this again, mean C and mean E without mean D only exist in the cytoplasm. When mean C is overproduced by orders of magnitude, it can actually inhibit division everywhere. Mean D associates with the membrane, on the membrane, it needs ATP for that, and it pulls mean C with it. When you add mean E to this, what you see is what you saw yesterday. You start to see oscillations. So the oscillations look like that. I think it's important to look at the nature of the oscillation. If you look at mean D, it forms a cap, a horseshoe. And then as time passes, the horseshoe becomes smaller and smaller. And then at some point, you start to form a full horseshoe on the other side. And then the horseshoe becomes smaller and smaller. Then it somehow disappears and it forms on the other side. If you look at mean C, it does exactly the same thing. Mean C starts to form some kind of a cap, becomes smaller and smaller, and then it reappears on the other side, becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, diffused, then at some point it's diffused through the whole cell and it reappears on the other side. So the fact that mean C and mean D exhibit the same kind of oscillations underlines what I said before, that it actually mean C is only carried by mean D. Concentration of? I said it's about 1,000 proteins per micron. No, it's micron length. I mean, the cell is a few microns. Min E does something slightly different. If you look at min E, it forms some enhanced concentration at somewhere along the cell. You can think of this as a ring, for example, and the ring just moves. And then at some point it disperses, it reappears at the center, and now it moves to the other side. Disappears, and then reappears in the center and moves to the other side. The reason that it becomes weaker and weaker is because the GFP protein that is used for looking at those proteins actually decays as a function of time. So if you try to look at this as a movie, you can see that, you know, you start from some kind of a horseshoe, it disappears, reforms on the other half, becomes smaller and smaller, disperses through the medium, and then again starts to reform on the other side. If you look at a bunch of cells under the microscope, you see that they are all oscillating like fireflies. And they all have approximately the same time scale.
Do they synchronize?
Maybe Eshel will tell you that.
Is there a shift of mass? Hmm?
There is a shift of mass. I'm going to talk about it. Okay. I'm going to talk about a single cell. Okay. Now, what happens if you have, if you look at both min E and min D? It's pretty hard to have them in different colors, so they express both of them with GFP. And what you see is that you have the min E ring, which is basically pushing, if you wish, the min D towards the cell. And then it reaches the end. Somehow it disperses. You see the min D reaching the other side, and suddenly the min E somehow nucleates on the edge of the min D cap and eats it up, if you wish.
What's the time scale for the shuttling of the mass?
It's about a minute, 1 minute between. I'll show you the time, the whole scale. The distance is a few microns.
So it's not diffusion.
It's diffusion. It's a typical diffusion constant for in the cytoplasm of a cell.
What size?
I'll show you all everything. Okay, all the parameters.
So you think all these waves or temporal oscillations that have to be out?
No, there are actual waves.
Waves.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, min C inhibits division at a specific point. So in order for it to inhibit not to inhibit division at the cell center, it should not be there. So if it moves through the cell center, it has to move quick. It cannot just be there and oscillate. Okay, so what are the experimental observations? As I said, the min D polar regions grow as end caps. They start to form as an end cap and then become smaller. The min E ring caps the min D polar region, and actually it looks like it eats it up as it moves. The oscillation frequency, and I'll show you numbers later, depends on the concentration of the proteins. So the larger the concentration of the min E protein, the larger the frequency. The larger the concentration of the min D protein, the smaller the frequency. And in fact, the frequency is approximately equal to the ratio of those concentrations. Filamentous cells have zebra stripe patterns of oscillation. So if you look at, this is something you saw yesterday, if you look at a cell that was, for example, the FTSZ was knocked out, so it cannot divide, it just grows. If you look at the cell and you look as a function of time, you see that you have now two caps as a function of time. Or if you look at the min E, you see they have two rings. the rings, one ring moves to the right, one ring moves to the left. As they approach the end, they suddenly reappear in the center, and now there are two rings that move towards the center. If you look at the mean D, for example, you see that you have a zebra pattern that alternates as a function of time. And you see it's 20 seconds, 40 seconds. This is the time scale. So this defines some wavelength of the oscillations. And in fact, you can see, as this is a real picture of the mean D protein, you see that it actually moves. Okay, it alternates from here to there. I'm going to skip that. If I have time, I'll come back to that. Okay, so there were some previous models. I think the most interesting part of those models is that they do generate oscillations. So they show that you don't really need to have some marker at the cell center in order to avoid division there. But I think they fail to reproduce some of the observed behavior. I usually don't talk in details about other theories, but since Andrew is here, I can say what I think is wrong with his theory, and he can comment later if he wishes. So first, as Andrew himself said, basically you put some ad hoc assumptions. I mean, you put the parameters in to get oscillations. So those normalized parameters that he was talking about, there's some interaction between the mean E and the cytoplasmic mean D that I think there's no, at least that so far, there's no biological basis for that. If you look at the pictures that they were generated, the mean D polar region actually do not form from the poles outward, but actually they form somewhere not far from the pole and then move towards the pole. And the incorrect dependence of the frequency on the concentration of mean E.
What's from the pole outward? What's outward?
Outward means that when the mean D cap forms, it actually forms on the whole cap. It doesn't form at the center and moves towards the pole, but when it reappears as a whole horseshoe. So that's what I mean outward.
How much can you trust those experiments? Because they're the resolution limit of the grayscales. They put in some false color to make us believe that there's a signal. And I mean, they have like 3-4 grayscales there. I mean, we don't really see the full oscillations. We see perhaps the highest intensities.
Yes, what you see.
We see the peaks of the oscillation.
Right. I mean, if you think it's a three-dimensional cell and you project it on a plane, so what you see really is, the part of the proteins that are attached to the membrane. I mean, that's where you're going to see a higher signature. So I think that, I mean, you saw the pictures themselves, okay? And those, I showed you one group. They are, I don't know if I mentioned, but I think in one of the transparencies there were a list of 5 groups that actually see this. And at the end, I'm going to show you something that even is much higher resolution than what I showed you before.
But the question is, what do they see?
I mean, I show you what they show, okay?
It's not a picture of what's there. There are optical effects.
Right. Okay. I mean, at the end, you can even ask other questions. Okay, so basically, my question is when I read, I saw this experiment and read the theories was, how far can you go based on available experimental information? So that's all I want to try to answer today. Just look at the available experimental information, try to build up a model which is only based on known experimental interactions and see how far can you go from this. And before I do this, let me mention another experimental observation of something that was also mentioned yesterday, some in vitro studies of the mean D protein. Mean D, when it catches ATP, it binds and forms and polymerizes. So it forms actually a lattice. So mean D actually likes to attach to another mean D protein. And the mean E induces hydrolysis. So the mean E comes to the mean D that is already in a lattice and attaches to it and hydrolyzes it, which means that it turns the ATP into ADP. And that causes a disassembly of the lattice. This causes the mean D to leave the membrane into the cytoplasm. So this is the physics I'm going to talk about. Those are the processes. So you have a MinD ATP, and as I said, MinD ATP can attach to the membrane. Now it can attach to the membrane, but it is a higher affinity to the membrane if there is already another MinD ATP protein there. It wants to form some kind of an ordered lattice, and I'll come to that to the end. So this guy can live happily on the membrane unless there's some MinE around, and the MinE comes in, and if it sees a MinD on the membrane, it can attach to the MinD, and then causes hydrolysis, which means that the MinE, MinD ATP, the ATP goes into ADP and another phosphorus, and then the MinD has to leave the membrane, and of course the MinE also leaves the membrane. So there's this process of hydrolysis which causes MinD to leave the membrane. Now the MinD ADP, after it left the membrane, cannot immediately attach to the membrane. And that's the key point, key assumption in the theory. It now has an ADP. In order to reattach to the membrane, it has to release this ADP and catch an ATP. So there's another step in this process, and this is what I think causes the oscillations. Of course, MinC does not appear in this, and the assumption, as in all the other theories, is that the MinC is already just carried by the MinD. So the minimal theory will only include MinD and MinE. So you have a bunch of equations. Let me go, for example, over some of them. This is, for example, the density of MinD ADP in the cytoplasm. This guy can diffuse. It can, it's generated by MinD ATP that is hydrolyzes by MinE, so there is a linear term here, and it is at there's some rate where it becomes MinD ATP, so there is some linear term, there's a linear term that is just the rate at which it disappears. If you look at the ATP, MinD ATP in the cytoplasm, it also diffuses. It is generated by the same term as MinD ADP, and then it can attach to the membrane. It can either attach directly to the membrane, or if there's already some MinD on the membrane, it has some higher probability rate to attach to the membrane. If you look at MinE in the cytoplasm, it also can diffuse. It is generated by the same term that is responsible for the hydrolysis of this complex of MinD, MinE, ATP, and it is can attach to the membrane when it sees MinD on the membrane and of course when it's there's some MinE in the cytoplasm. If you look at MinD on the membrane, then it when it becomes it is destroyed, well, it is turned into this complex by MinE, and then it is generated by this attaching of MinD to the membrane, which I mentioned before, and the other term is the same. So there are various parameters here. If you look at the diffusion constant, that's the typical diffusion constant. We put it by hand. I'll talk about what combination of parameters is important to generate the oscillations. Now, as was said repeatedly yesterday, I wouldn't have been here, standing here, if this model would not lead to oscillations. I should mention that this model leads to oscillation only when you do a three-dimensional calculation. In one dimension, it does not do. Does not produce oscillations. Okay, so as I said, the... Okay, some of them are known approximately. Oh, these guys. Some of them there is, by some in vitro studies, there are some huge range of... but basically, I mean, you put arbitrary numbers and you get a time scale. And you change them to get the time scale that you want. So there are some. I'll tell you what is the important parameters in the theory to that are related to the time scale and the length scale that you see experimentally.
The order of magnitude is fixed. You know roughly what the order of magnitude is. So can you change it by a factor of 1,000?
There are some parameters where the biologists know order of magnitude. There are some parameters that they have no idea of. There are some measurements. I mean, now, actually, there are, for example, in Ben-Gurion University, they They actually use some physics type labs that actually try to measure this to very high accuracy. Yes?
In your stability analysis,
I'll come to that.
On dimension, spatial dimension. So you said that.
No, they do. They do depend. I'll show you. But I mean, the size of the matrix depends on dimension.
Okay.
Okay, so again, what you see is that you start, if you look at the mean D, for example, you see that you start from, you get some kind of a cap, the cap becomes smaller, then it's diffusive, then it starts to generate on the other side, becomes smaller, etc. So, and what you see is that you have some minimal concentration of mean D in the center, which means minimal concentration of mean C at the center, which means that there is a higher probability of FTSZ to form at the center and leads to cell division.
So your calculation is in a rectangular solid? What is your calculation of volume?
Yes, it's a...
It's 3D?
It's 3D. It's effectively... it's a cylinder. So it's effectively 2D.
Cylinder.
Cylinder, yes.
And do you do a 2D calculation assuming axis symmetry, or do you do a 3D?
Yes.
Yes, so you do a 2D calculation.
Yes. I mean, when I say I do, I should, I mean, again, give credit to Casey Wong, who done the whole calculation. It's basically the boundary condition says that there is no flow outside the cell. Okay, so the mean E ring, again, you see that if you look at the mean E, there is some higher concentration here, it moves to the left. Then when it reaches this, it reappears somewhere here, moves to the right, etc. So let me say a few words why you get oscillations, why this model gives you oscillations. And the reason is the following. You have mean D ejected, let's say that you have some cap, and you have mean D ejected from the membrane, and then it can diffuse around. Now, we say that the mean D has a very high probability to attach to the membrane if there's already mean D there. So if this mean D could attach instantaneously back to the membrane, it wouldn't have left this side. The point is, there is a time delay. This mean D cannot reattach to the membrane before it releases this ADP and catch another ATP. So there's a time scale before this mean D can attach to the membrane. During this time scale, it can diffuse. Now, those guys that are on this side, I mean, those guys that diffused and remained on this side almost immediately reattached to the membrane. Those guys on the other side, the diffused, now there is a much higher concentration in the cytoplasm. If you look at the mean D in the cytoplasm, there is a much higher concentration of mean D on the other side of the cell. And those guys can nucleate and immediately cause another cap to form. Now, they form and they can live here happily because all the mean E that is released, mean E can reattach immediately to mean D. So the mean E in this region will not leave this region until it eats up all the mean D here.
So the ATP is homogeneously?
The ATP or the mean D?
Yeah, the ATP is
assumed to be homogeneous. I mean, we didn't put any ATP in the model. We just said there's a constant uniform rate of converting ADP to ATP. So if you look at the... So if you look at the model calculation, you see this mean ADP diffuses around. The mean E is still busy here. Now it finishes here, it catches, goes at the other end, and starts to catch up with the mean D, starts to eat it up. The released mean D goes and can explore the whole cell, nucleates on the other side, and then the mean E, after it finishes here, turns around, run after it, and then it catches it up. Yes?
So the process eats ATP?
Yes, of course.
And what do you think is the evolutionary advantage to the cell of having this oscillation?
Okay, that's a question that also was raised yesterday. If I have time at the discussion time, I'll talk about it, okay?
I was going to ask, is this a significant ATP usage for the cell? Or is this
in the noise.
Well, I don't know the who.
Well, we have some questions for you.
Okay, so how, I mean, approximately 10 minutes, 20 minutes?
Tell him that he has 10 minutes.
Give like 3, 4 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah,
so, okay. So the period, I mean, the period is determined by the rate at which the mean E can eat up a whole cap of mean D, right? I mean, the mean E, the period is determined by the mean E comes, starts with a cap, eats up all the mean D on one side, and then turns around and chases the mean D to the other side. So the period, half of the period, is how long it takes the mean E to eat one cap of mean D. And of course, the more mean E you get, the faster this process is. The more mean D you get, the slower the process is. And if you plot the time scale the period of the oscillation as a function of mean D and mean E, you get exactly or approximately what you see experimentally, which means that it is proportional to this ratio. And in fact, what you see is that if mean D concentration is too low, you don't get any oscillations. And this is also borne out by experiment where they don't see oscillation periods less than 20, 30 seconds. Okay. So one can do a linear stability analysis. You get some kind of instability. What you see is that when you start to feed the first instability, it occurs at a finite wavelength and a finite frequency. This is why in the previous plot you have this instability, and then you start to see oscillation with a finite frequency. If you want to see, for example, a given cell size, when the oscillation will start, you have to increase the mean D, for example. The parameters that we change here is the mean D concentration. You change the mean D concentration until this becomes unstable, and then you start to see oscillations. What's interesting here is you can actually get period doubling, because if the cell, this is done for an infinite cell. So if you want to ask yourself what a given cell size, what wavelengths are responsible, then all wavelengths that are that correspond to the boundary conditions, so there are many wavelengths that correspond to a given cell size, so you can get two wavelengths, and it really the question of which one is more unstable. So you can get, if you go to larger and larger cell size, you suddenly see that you get period doubling, that the wavelength that correspond to a particular cell size is not the half wavelength. So let me reiterate, the oscillations are uniform limit cycle, so the uniform solution is unstable, and they occur for a large range of mean D and mean E concentration. So there's a robustness. I skip through this. So as I said, you can get for larger cell size, you can get a period doubling, which means that the cell now oscillates like this instead of from side to side. And this actually corresponds to the experimental observation that if you look at the position of the FTSZ ring in cells as a function of the cell length, you see that it's this is the position of the FTSZ ring. This is the cell length. And you see that up to some critical value, the position is always at the center. And then there's a sharp transition. And then the position is in the 1/4 and 3/4 positions, exactly what you expect. So again, the result of the model, delay of mean D is essential, mean D recovery. The rate, the frequency is set by the rate of the hydrolysis. And the length scale is set by the how far can the mean D diffuse before reattaching back to the membrane. So there's one combination of parameters in the theory that determines the time scale, and one combination of parameters in the theory that determines the length scale. Let me finish by just saying a few open questions. First, there are some observations that mean E, for example, does not move in the same direction all the time. You can see here that it moves to the right, and then suddenly it stutters moves to the left and to the right again. So that probably is related to noise, which was emphasized yesterday by Andrew. Min E actually is a dimer. The min E molecule, it forms a molecule of two min E proteins, and it's not clear what the role of the dimerization is. I think that there's a whole subject of a feedback between the nucleoid and the min, and the min oscillations. Each one of them separately gives you a rather poor accuracy of cell division. Somehow, when they are both there, the accuracy is very high, and there are some other indications why they talk to each other, which I did not have time to go into. And the last observation was also made yesterday. This is the most recent observations. You can see that if you look, for example, at the min D, it is this is raw data. So you can read from that, you know, what you want. But it does look like it forms a helix. So it's not like the whole thing moves back and forth as in bulk, but there is some kind of the nucleation process, or maybe there's some underlying structure that they claim may be something more complicated or less trivial. Okay, so I think I said all this. Let me mention just there was a question of why does the cell need this? And this is something that intrigued us or still intrigues us. There are other organisms that finds the cell center or in very high accuracy without oscillations. So it's not clear why some organisms do this and some why organisms do that. One of the reasons that one can invoke, or one of the situations where you can think that this oscillation will be advantageous to the cell, is in some SOS response. So that means that the cell, there's some external condition where the cell says, I don't want to divide, I'll just grow and grow, and then at some point it wants to divide. Now, when it wants to divide, when it's big, if it only has static, it knows the center by some static mean, it can divide only in the center. But when it grows, it actually duplicates the DNA every time, every so many minutes, and that means that you have many DNA molecules. And by this oscillatory behavior, when you have a typical wavelength, it actually divides simultaneously at several positions. So it can grow faster. And this actually has been seen experimentally. There are some experiments at BGU where they are planning to test the role of interaction between the proteins and the min proteins and the nucleoid. And last statement before I finish, if you look at all the genomes that are known for various bacteria, you see that min D is very ubiquitous. It appears, and this group of proteins appear at many, many known bacteria. So somehow this mechanism is not only for the E. coli, but may be relevant to other organisms. And there are some min D homologs that are responsible for other processes in the cell. So that maybe that oscillations are also important in other areas. Thank you.
We have a little time for questions. We're a little short in time. So.
So the dimension of space appears, if I understand, only through the fact that in the Laplacian there is a curved space in Laplace-Beltrami operator for diffusion.
No. The dimension, it's important that when min D, let's say that you think of the membrane as a line.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so when the min D leaves the membrane,
uh-huh.
It's important that it can diffuse in the
underlying direction, okay.
And will not be adjacent to the membrane all the time.
Ah, okay.
Thanks. Can you say something about my question on evolution? What's the evolutionary advantage, if any, to these oscillations?
Well, I tried to say something about.
I know you weren't there when it was done.
Well, you'll be surprised how old I am. I can't say anything intelligible about it. I mean, Eschel, I know, is dying to say something, but...
We
We had a long discussion yesterday.
Well, you said something about the Coulombesta's case.
Yes, I said, but, you know.
I very much like the your talk. I guess I should say something. The I think there's a real challenge with these models when you have, you know, 6, 8, 17 parameters about how we're going to constrain them and falsify or validate or use that, basically use the model to identify what those parameters are microscopically. And I think one organizing principle that biologists use is that all these systems are having selective pressure. And I think it's something worth exploring in a relatively well understood system like this, that it might be optimized, for instance, for reproduction rate. So I think it would be intriguing to see if you could optimize a system like this and see if the parameters come out to describe the observed oscillation. And that might be a mechanism of constraining the model a lot. So that's a possibility. For instance, I think it's great that there's a number of different models out, and I hope the experimentalists, either the biologists or the physicists, start shooting us down. For instance, you have a nucleotide exchange rate that hasn't been measured, but in principle can be relatively easily, and you're very dependent on that. And I think you're also very dependent on the min-E to min-D ratio. You have less min-E so that it can, I believe you have less min-E, and that allows it to stick at the end cap and localize there. And if you flip the ratio around, I'm not sure if it would work as well. But I do have a question, which is, how overexpressed can you put it at the same ratio and it still works? So I know the R model breaks, and that's a flaw of it. I didn't mention that. But we can't overexpress it more than about 50%. And experimentally, they can overexpress at the same ratio to a factor of 10. And I see that, for instance, as a particular challenge of a working model.
Okay, let me... I'm not sure if I remember all the comments. First, about the number of parameters. As I said, at the moment, there are particular experimental observations, which is the time scale, the length scale. As I said, you have this number of parameters, but the time scale depends on specific combinations. So we can change one of the parameters arbitrarily and change another parameters to compensate for that. So there is really, in that sense, there are less constraints in the theory than you would have liked to. You would have liked to maybe people to look to do more elaborate experiments. I personally found it hard to convince biologists to do that. I haven't finished. I think there were some other questions. You want to answer him? Okay.
Can we postpone it?
Yeah. To ask a short question, is there a prediction that you can make according to the prediction in your model contradicts the prediction that contradicts the other one?
Not in the sense that you have a different value of the parameter, but qualitative behavior, which is...
The dependence on the ratio you mentioned, is that not seen in...
That's in experimentally, but that contradicts, if I understand correctly, the prediction of your model.
The dependence of the frequency on the ratio, that's the one he mentioned.
And that can be found out.
No, that I mean, experimentally, we are, I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the only model that has the right dependence on this ratio.
Let me. On some level, it's sort of like IPC superconductivity, where depending on your phenomena, your model works very well. And the challenge is to get your model to work well on the phenomena that people focus on. So,
okay, I'm not aware of
a lot of parameter freedom. We could, for instance, try to optimize our model for the ratio of min D to min E, and it's not clear.
No, but that's that has nothing to do with parameters. The dependence is the physics. I try to explain where the physics come from, And it's clear that why it depends on this ratio in this way. Now, your second question. We actually did not see any problem with overexpressing. I showed, I think, the graph. The problem comes actually when the number is very, very small. That's where I think the model breaks down. And if it's actually what we see is that they are two stable, uniform solutions to the model. If the MINDI and MINI are well underexpressed.
So. Maybe overexpressed.